Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Karma Management, First Part, and Martin Luther King Day, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhinatha Velayatha Swami. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
Taking it more into the Hindu realm for this morning, in terms of our theme of parents as gurus and the need for parents to teach tolerance. So I have a few thoughts on that. The simplest definition of tolerance is freedom from prejudice. And prejudice, of course, is defined as suspicion, intolerance, or irrational hatred of other races, creeds, or regions. So Gurudeva has a nice writing on tolerance in Living with Shiva, which I thought I'd read. If you ever wondered why Living with Shiva has two bookmarks, one is for the lesson of the day and one is for the sutra of the day. That's why it's got two. Okay. I'm having difficulty in this light. I think I'm going to have to... Sarvanaswami, if you could get my glasses. I can't read this type in this light. Come back to that in a minute. Turning to the question of how can we cultivate tolerance in children? In other words, you can't simply say, children, be tolerant. You know, don't be prejudiced. It doesn't work like that. You know, we have to go about it in a more systematic way. So here's a few thoughts on that. I think the first one is the idea we brought forth recently, and that's stressing that divinity exists within all people. Even people trying to harm us, or even people who dislike us, the divinity still exists within them, and we need to recognize that. This secular pledge puts it another way. Every person is a treasure, so they don't want to talk about divinity. But that's how they're putting the same idea. Every person is special. Every person is a treasure. Every person is divine. It's just that some people aren't manifesting that divinity in this lifetime. They're manifesting other qualities. But that doesn't mean it's not there. It's within each of us. And we need to teach children to respect everyone, to treasure everyone, because the divine is within them. The second point is to avoid ethnic generalizations and stereotypes, both good and bad, and focus on individuals and recognizing the qualities of that particular individual. Why would we want to avoid generalizations that are good? Because we're not looking at the individual then, even if we make good generalizations. For example, quite often we have, not quite often, but a few times a year we have Japanese groups come here. And they're always so well-mannered, so well-behaved. All the shoes are lined up in a perfect row. And they all come forward and they're so respectful. So it's easy to make generalizations about Japanese people. Oh, Japanese people are also cultured. But that's a dangerous statement, because then we stop discriminating between one Japanese person and another. We're not looking at each Japanese person as an individual with different characteristics. So if we're not looking at each individual because we're making good generalizations, it's easy to start making bad generalizations because we haven't learned to look at individuals. So even good generalizations about groups of people, Chinese people are all industrious, is a dangerous statement to make in front of a child, because you're teaching the child not to look at each individual person and distinguish the characteristics in that person. I was looking at Dr. Martin Luther King's famous speech, I Have a Dream, and one of his statements which relates to this point is, I have a dream that my children will be recognized because of their character, which is this idea that individuals will look at his children and see the qualities in them, not make generalizations about them because they're black or because they're Dr. Martin Luther King's children or for this reason or that reason, but actually look deep into the individual, discern the qualities that are there, recognize them for who they are, honor them for who they are, not because of some generalization. So that's an important point, and of course it's easy to make ethnic generalizations, comments like this, just casually, watching television, because television often depicts stereotypes of people. They take, for example, the Indian. They have a certain stereotype of someone from India, and he's usually not very dynamic. If it's a man I'm talking about, tend to portray Indians as not dynamic people, but somewhat soft-spoken and so forth. So this is a stereotype that goes into the mind, and so if we see stereotypes on television, it's important to correct the mind of a child. Indians aren't all like that. This is a false concept. The media is portraying a stereotype. So we need to make children aware of these stereotypes. Another area is social interaction. This became quite apparent to me when I visited Australia about 5 years ago, and one of the activities there was a youth seminar. Older youth, I think from about age 18 through 25, so youth and young adults. And all Australians of Indian descent except for one or two, because it was a Hindu temple group. And so somehow the conversation turned to Americans at some point. They were asking questions about Americans, and they had some strange ideas about Americans. Mm-hmm. One of them that was like Americans were like John Wayne somehow. And this and that. And I realized, my goodness, you know, they haven't really socially interacted with Americans. They don't know Americans. They haven't had the opportunity to be with Americans. They haven't grown up with Americans. They're suffering from stereotypes about Americans because they have not socially interacted with them. Therefore, they have false concepts, false beliefs, and so forth, and they tend to generalize. They tend to have generalizations. Well, Americans are like this, Americans are like that. Well, of course, Americans would be the same way toward Australians, as most Americans have not had the opportunity to socially interact with Australians, so they have these general concepts. Oh, Australians are like this, Australians are like that, which of course isn't true. Australians are individuals. Each one is potentially quite different from the other. So, what's the problem? The problem is we develop false concepts about other people simply by not having the opportunity to socially interact with them. So therefore, the idea is make sure your children interact with children of other ethnicities and religions at school, at play, and learn to feel comfortable with them. So, of course, opportunities are not infinite, but we can take advantage of the opportunities wherever we live to the best of our ability to make sure that children mix with children of different backgrounds and learn to feel comfortable with them. Once children get over the difference, they're very comfortable with each other because they all love to play and do the same things if they're in similar ages. You know, there's not a lot of natural resistance there. Second idea to provide to your own children, with an appropriate amount of fun involved, information on the customs, languages, and history of the other children. So you don't want to make it too tedious, but this book points out fun ways such as websites and children's books that tell stories and all, where they can learn about children of these different backgrounds that they're interacting with and become knowledgeable in the differences and understand the cultural differences, religious differences. Then the third point is to value diversity. Teach that there is a strength in diversity, that combining different perspectives, sensitivities, backgrounds, creates a group that has the potential to act with greater effectiveness and wisdom than a less diverse group. Our monastery is a good example of that principle of diversity. We have individuals from a number of different countries in the monastery. But of course, we're all Saivites. And the diversity gives us a strength, because coming from different backgrounds, we bring different qualities together. So it's like Gurudeva's statement, combine the best of the East and the best of the West. You've heard him say that. So we're combining the best of a number of different countries together in a monastery. And therefore, it's a more effective and wise group in its actions because of that diversity. So diversity is a strength. And if we can utilize that principle and utilize it in working with children and working with different situations to try and create diversity that's appropriate to different situations, then children learn to value the diversity of a group, which is quite the opposite of wanting everyone else to be just like you, which is how some people are because they haven't been raised this way. They kind of fear that which is different. They're most comfortable with themselves and other people who are exactly like them. But through this kind of raising of children, children can be made to feel quite comfortable with people who are very different, enjoy those differences, and learn to work together in a more effective and wise manner. Well, now we get to read Living with Shiva, because we can see it. I spoke on global education in January of 1990 at the Global Forum for Human Survival, Development, and Environment in Moscow. My message to the 700 religious and political leaders there was that we need, in the century ahead, to teach all children tolerance, openness to different ways of life, different beliefs, different customs of dress, and language. We need to stop teaching them to fear those who are different from themselves. Stop teaching them hatred for peoples of other colors and other religions. Stop teaching them to see the world as a field of conflict. And instead, instill in them an informed appreciation and a joyous reverence for the grand diversity we find around us. Modern education can do that, provided the approach is changed. Basic human Vedic values should be taught to every child and every student. These eternal values have nothing to do with race, creed, caste, politics, or ethnic culture. Learning how to read and write is not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal of education is also knowing what to read and what to write, as well as how to live in tune with nature, in harmony with the universe, and at peace with oneself and one's fellow man. A great Hindu saint once wrote, "Those who cannot live in harmony with the world, though they have learned many things, are still ignorant." And then in conclusion, Gurudeva says, talking about the value of the family, "While the family is suffering a lot in many parts of the world, it is still very strong in Hindu society. We have to keep it that way and teach the world by our example that it is the family that nurtures the individual and stabilizes the religion and hence the nation. Only by keeping a strong sense of family can humankind hope for a secure future. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya. One of our church activities that's going to begin, I believe, this month in Malaysia, they're starting a one-day youth seminar. And a lot of inspiration there. They have an outline for a day-long activity presenting a number of topics, which Arvind Raj and Sivaneshwaran are instrumental in taking back the idea from their six-month task force program here and pushing it through the COM there and bringing it all to manifestation. So we're very happy to see that, and there's certainly lots of youth in Malaysia that will benefit from being exposed to Gurudeva's teachings. So one of the sections in that seminar is on karma, and I've been thinking about karma a lot recently because when I'm asked questions about karma, the questions are so far off the mark, you know, as to what they should be. And so I was wondering, what's going on here? What is missing? So, of course, from just individuals who aren't familiar at all with our teachings, you get the common stereotypes such as, well, what's the point of trying anyway? You know, it's all in my karma. No matter what I do, it's going to work out the same way. So why bother? You get that one quite often. Which, of course, is a total misunderstanding. But even when understanding exists, you know, such as from reading Merging with Shiva and Gurudeva's other writings on karma, you know, karma is the law of cause and effect, and we know, of course, the three kinds of karma. We can rattle them off, sanchita, prabdha, and kriyamana, and, you know, we understand. That isn't enough. You know, just understanding correctly what karma is, isn't the final goal here. We need to take this understanding and apply it to our life in a way which changes our life so that we refine the way we act and react to life. So, I have a story to begin. I have a new writer and he likes stories, so a new story for you. It's about a story about loaning a car. So a family loaned its one car to a neighbor for the day as the neighbor's car wasn't working. Then unexpectedly, late in the morning, the family needed the car to go to town for an unexpected and important errand. At the very moment, the mother said to her son, "We need to go to town right away." The son heard a car pulling in their driveway, looked out the window, and turned to the mother and said, "Our karma." Yeah, our karma. So, so it was both their car, of course, and it was their karma that they had done a generous act, and so in their moment of need, their car came back, our karma. So, anyway, another story. Trying to get an overview on the understanding of karma is also important, because sometimes we understand it, but we get an underview. We understand it kind of from a bottom-up point of view. We're looking at it, but we don't really see it in its totality. So this is this little story to comparison, actually, to try and give us a sense of looking at it from the top down. So if we imagine a kingdom, say a Hindu kingdom existing some 2,000 years ago when kingdoms were common, The kingdom, of course, had laws and governing misbehavior such as murder, theft, and so forth. And when a citizen broke the law, he was punished by the king, of course. Likewise, the king rewards those who perform outstanding service to the kingdom. So in that situation, the king is very busy punishing and rewarding according to the law and according to standards of behavior those who live in the kingdom. So it all goes along very well. So if we imagine that the king is God Shiva and his laws are initially unwritten, of course, because the king is invisible and his laws are invisible, but eventually they're written down in scripture. Wise men figure out the laws that govern life and they write them down for us, and they're passed on from one generation to the next. So we end up with the laws of conduct, virtuous conduct, non-virtuous conduct, definitions of dharma and adharma. So we've got the laws, but how do the laws get enforced? The king's invisible. God is invisible. So he's not around to enforce them. So that's where karma comes in. Karma is the system of justice that's built into life. It's automatic. It's like a computer program. God Shiva doesn't have to watch everything that happens and reward and punish. No, he's put a program, a computer program, into effect so that an action creates a reaction. A cause creates an effect. So it's a system of justice that's built right into life. Invisible system. So justice is known for moving very slowly, right? You know, it takes a number of years before a criminal receives his punishment. Say in the U.S., it might take 5, even 10 years before the punishment actually is received. However, the law of karma is even slower. It can take many lifetimes before the reward or punishment comes back. So consequently, you get a large backlog of rewards and punishments, right? Because we're acting all the time. But the reaction, the effect, doesn't come back to us except over a long period of time. So the karma we bring into a life are the rewards and punishments from our past actions we have yet to receive. They're pending. They're coming, but it's a slow process. So our own past actions are creating this backlog of rewards and punishments, which we carry from one life to another and constitutes our karma. A few years ago, I had the pleasure of conducting a lecture with Jagadeesan, a very fine religious person from Malaysia who's a leader in the Sai Baba movement there. So I got to go first and give my talk, which was on enlightenment. It's pointing out the process of enlightenment and how we don't sit there totally unenlightened and then one day lightning flashes and we become enlightened. No, it doesn't work like that. It's not like the storybook idea of enlightenment that we go from total ignorance to total enlightenment in a split second. It's a gradual process. And I went through the whole explanation of the different ways we realize God gradually, starting with Gurudev's favorite, which is look into the other person's eyes, see the light, what are you seeing? You're seeing God. Everyone can see God. So I started there and was going through and went through everything. And then it's Jagadeesan's turn. And he's a very charismatic speaker. And he was talking and acknowledging what I'd said. And one of the points he made is that, unfortunately today, Hindus don't pay that much attention to the traditional wisdom given by the Swamis. But this wisdom gets repackaged into secular self-improvement seminars based upon Hindu principles, and Hindus go to them and pay thousands of dollars. But isn't this a strange phenomena? that the teachings are free, given by the Swamis, but someone, rather than going and listening and understanding, will pay thousands of dollars to go to a self-improvement seminar based upon just a few of the principles. So I took that into account. So I've created a self-improvement seminar, so to speak, on karma. And it's called, you know, you've heard of stress management workshops. This is called a karma management workshop. Karma management workshop. So this is part one of our karma management workshop, which you have to come back next Sun 1 for part two. So you're like the seven habits of highly effective people and so on. They make a list of all these points. Like the first habit, of course, is be proactive, right? So we've got our principles here. Our first principle is we have to take responsibility. Okay? Take responsibility. So, karma manifests through other people. We're just not sitting there and a rock falls on our head. Usually someone does something to us. There's another person involved. And therefore, it's easy to blame it on the other person. For example, we're hit by a car and our leg is broken. So, natural response is, well, we're upset with the driver, right? Who hit us? We're really mad. This person broke my leg, you know, through carelessness. I'm really upset with that person. So, that's not taking responsibility. We're blaming the other person, saying that person made a mistake. I did perfectly well, and that person made a mistake, and so forth and so on. So, the correct perspective is to see yourself as responsible for whatever happens to you. Take responsibility. You caused yourself to be hit by a car and to end up with a broken leg. You caused yourself to experience that. The other person was simply the instrument for your karma. How many times do we really look at it that way? Probably not as often as we should. You know, it's so easy to blame the other person for doing something wrong and to see us as perfect, but no, that misses the point. We have to take responsibility for everything that happens to us. Gurudeva has a nice statement in this regard. As long as we externalize the source of our success and failures, we perpetuate the cycles of karma, good and bad. There is no one out there making it all happen. Our actions, thoughts, and attitudes make it all happen. So, human nature, of course, it's always easy to take responsibility when things go well, right? A few thousand dollars extra comes in somehow, and you say, boy, you know, what good karma. This is great. What did I do in my past life to earn this, you know, and you're so happy, but then you lose $2,000 unexpectedly and you start to blame someone. You say, boy, that person sure gave me bad advice. So somehow we're willing to take, more willing to take, shall we say, responsibility for things that go well than for things that don't go well. So, of course, the Tirukkural has a comment on that. It says, why should those who rejoice when destiny brings them good moan when that same destiny decrees misfortune? Because it's human nature. But, of course, the wise point of view is take responsibility. No matter if something goes well or something goes poorly, no matter who is the instrument to return your karma to you, realize that it's your karma that's coming to you. It has nothing to do with the person that's there. It's your karma. Everything you face is your karma. So take responsibility. That's our first principle. Okay? Ready for our second principle? Second principle. Forgive the offender. Okay, we have a story here. A schoolboy, teenage schoolboy, on the way home from school, runs into a gang. And the boy is somehow different, the way he dresses or looks. And so the gang teases him for being different and then beats him up. Okay, leaves him there. So the boy, of course, has the common reaction of being upset with the gang. He's not only upset this week, he's upset this month. He's upset this year. He's upset next year. In fact, he's never going to forget that this gang beat him up on this day. That's a normal reaction, right? You just cling to something like that, and you're really upset with the people that do it. So Gurudeva often told the story of Swami Sivananda. Most of us remember that story. It goes something like this. Swami Sivananda was at his ashram in Rishikesh, and some man comes up to him and starts beating him up, just out of nowhere. And so Swami's disciples managed to grab hold of the man, and not only that, they throw him in the local jail. So the next day, Swami Sivananda, garland in hand, goes to the jail, garlands the person, and thanks the person. He says, "Thank you so much for returning this karma to me. It's now gone. I'm no longer carrying it, and I'm so happy to be free from this karma. Thank you so much for being the instrument to bring this karma back to me." Isn't that a wise point of view? But how often do we not forgive the offender? We're missing the point, right? We're compounding the situation instead of looking at it, that it's an action coming back to us, and focusing on the action and being happy to receive it, because it's one less karmic burden. We get upset with the person who expresses it. We're so upset we're not going to forgive them. We're going to be mad at them forever because they did that to us. Tirukkural says, "Forget anger toward all who have offended you, for it gives rise to teeming troubles." One of the troubles is it just keeps the mind disturbed, particularly when you start building these up, because it never happens just once, right? It happens when we're 10 years old, and it happens when we're 15 years old, and then 20 and 22 and so forth. It's happened to us 10, 20 times, right? And we can remember every single time, and it's still swirling around in our subconscious, disturbing us, making it difficult to meditate, difficult to concentrate. We're certainly not at peace. Why? Because we have not forgiven the offender. So when we're able to look at it as our karma and we're happy to receive it, we don't pay any attention to the offender. Or in Swami Sivananda's case, we thank the offender. We're so understanding of the process that we're happy to have it happen. Ready for the third principle. Okay. Don't retaliate. There's no need for us be the instrument to return the karmic reaction to someone else. For example, someone is nasty to us. So, of course, we have to be nasty back, right? And then because we were nasty to them, they're nasty to us again, right? And because they were nasty to us, we feel obligated to be nasty to them. This could go on forever, right? So you get stuck in these cycles that are endless. But the wise approach is to say, okay, that person's being nasty, kind of just step back, let the nastiness go by, and let it come around and go back to them by itself. You don't need to be the one to be the instrument to return it to them. It's going to go back to them through the law of karma. So the human response is to feel, well, they were nasty to me, therefore they deserved to have someone nasty to them, and I'm going to be the one to return it to them. That's the human response. But that's not the wise response. The wise response is, it's going to go back to them through the law of karma. I don't need to be involved, because if I give it back to them, then it'll come back to me. Let's just let karma take care of it. So it's like the classic cowboy movie. In the cowboy movies, they're always pursuing revenge. You know, it's like for example, a robbery. So there's a robbery that happens, and there's two brothers, and the robber takes the money but shoots one of the brothers, kills him. So what happens the rest of the movie? Of course, the other brother chases down the murderer and kills him, right? That's all you see. But what's the karma, of course? The brother has no right to kill someone. He's not free from the karma of killing someone just because that person killed his brother. So, the next movie would be the opposite, right? He would get killed. And then probably his brother would spend the rest of the movie going around and kill the robber. Then the next movie would be the same again, right? It goes on forever. So, of course, it shows the problem of retaliating. If you personally retaliate, you get stuck in the cycle of karma yourself, which is an endless cycle. You're just stuck and repeating and repeating. So let someone else take care of it. And in this case, a cowboy analogy, let the sheriff do it. You know, the sheriff is taking an oath, right? He's upholding the laws. So, of course, he tries to capture the person. And if in trying to capture the person gets killed, the sheriff has no karma for killing the person, because that's, he's taken an oath. He's upholding the law. So, as long as he tries not to kill the person, but if he ends up having to kill the person, he's okay. There's no karma involved. So we've ended the cycle of karma. The brother got killed. The sheriff goes and catches the killer. It doesn't keep going and going and going into future episodes here. It's just one movie, one time. Carol, if you return kindness for injuries received and forget both, those who harmed you will be punished by their own shame. So that's really wise. You know, not only do you not injure back, you return it with a kindness. And then you forget the whole thing. That's a really high-minded approach. Okay, ready for our fourth principle. Fourth principle is consider the consequences. Often, our actions are based upon an emotional reaction to what someone else has done. And we haven't really thought through clearly the consequences of what we're doing. We're responding. But we're responding more with our heart, more with our emotions than with our head. And consequently, we don't always respond in a wise way. So Gurudeva gives us some good advice in this regard. He says, it is our reaction to karmas through lack of understanding that create most karmas we shall experience at a future time. Let's look at that again. It is our reaction to karmas through lack of understanding. So something happens to us, and we don't take the time to understand it. We respond to it without clearly understanding what happened to us or what are the consequences of our response. Jirakaral has some good wisdom in this regard. As a man's shadow follows his footsteps wherever he goes, even so will destruction pursue those who commit sinful deeds. All suffering recoils on the wrongdoer himself. Thus those desiring not to suffer refrain from causing others pain. So there's a wonderful letter from Lord Ganesha in the Loving Ganesha book that starts out, keep track of your paces, for your walk makes marks. Each mark is a reward or a stumbling block. So everything we do makes a mark, meaning creates a karma. And that karma is either positive or negative. If it's positive here, it's called a reward. If it's negative, it's a stumbling block. So, therefore, the wise person thinks carefully about the consequences of all actions and avoids reacting, acting upon an emotional response, but thinks through clearly an action to make sure, what is the karma that I'm creating here? Is it a reward or is it a stumbling block?